All right, guys, welcome back to the show. Big one today. Very, very excited. I think most of you probably know, based upon the interactions that we've had on Instagram. Actually, no, Paulie, that's wrong, isn't it? Because depending on when the show comes out, this might be a long time ago. So, guys, welcome to the future. Paulie, mate, how are you?
I'm doing very well. We do have a few shows backed up, so we'll be dripping them out over the summer holidays. Speaking of summer and beautiful weather, my friend, you have abandoned the dark and gloomy, rainy climate that is in Victoria for brighter, greener pastures in Queensland.
It feels good. I feel a little bit more brown, a little tanned, so that's quite nice. And, no, we're loving it up here in Gold Coast. But it hasn't, you know, not too much of an issue. We're still talking over Zoom. We're still friends, I think. Maybe this is what we need to work through today.
No, very much looking forward to this chat, and good to see your new setup as well over in Queensland, mate.
Thank you, mate. No, well, let's get into it. And we were speaking before, Lissy, about how I came across you. I came across your book. Firstly, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here. And you know, Paulie and I are just really, really excited to pick your brain for today.
Oh, thank you both for having me. It's great to be here and to meet you in person.
Yeah, well, what we'll do is I'll read a bit about your background for context for the listeners. And like I said to you again before the show, there's been just such a giant amount of response from some of the questions that people have for you, which I think speaks to just the need and the demand out there for people really wanting to not only moving away from pain with regard to their relationships, but wanting their relationships to thrive and be optimized. So I think it's really wonderful that people are doing this. But let's have a listen. So Lissy Abrahams is an individual and couples psychotherapist. She was one of four candidates selected into a four-year couples psychotherapy master's in London at the world-renowned Institute Tavistock Relationships. Later, she tutored and lectured here. Lissy returned to Sydney and founded the Sydney-based therapy clinic Heath Group Practice. Now, guys, that's not Health Group, it's Heath Group. She works with clients around the world, has held positions on several psychotherapy associations, and has published academically. Lissy is the author of Relationship Reset, which I have here, ladies and gentlemen, and it is a really, really, really good book for professionals as well, by the way. You know, I'm a counsellor, and personally, you know, lots of takeaways for me in my own relationship, but even to work in the couple space as well. So thank you for writing it the way you did. It was really great. Lissy is the author of Relationship Reset and has a successful online course, Fight Less, Love More. She shares her knowledge via interviews in newspapers, podcasts, and TV appearances. She's also on Mamma Mia's Health Expert Panel. What is Mamma Mia's Health Expert Panel, by the way?
It's a group of people who are there that they can tap into, and they want to, in time, put them out into different forums and have days and longer kind of information gathering. So it's a group of people who are gathered up for particular reasons, and I'm there for relationships.
Love that. Awesome. Well, yeah, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
No, it's great to be here.
So one of the questions that we had from our listeners, which I thought would be a really great one to start, was psychotherapy, as we know, is just such a broad thing, and there are so many different ways that you can niche down, you know, whether it's psychoanalysis and all the various aspects within psychoanalysis and everything. What drew you to relationship and couples therapy?
Yeah, well, my journey to couples started many decades before my therapy training. So my mum was a family lawyer, and she started training when I was 15 to become a lawyer. And by the time that she was out there and working, there were so many cases that I heard about where people were doing it really tough. And it really got me thinking about, what are we doing in these relationships? How do people who start off with all of the promise in the world end up either separating some years later or absolutely annihilating each other in court processes? And I think I just wanted to go downstream or upstream and help people before they got to see people like my mum, who's not working at the moment, but she's retired. But it just was really sad. And there were some really tragic cases of people who were really left with quite dire predicaments post-separation. And it's just, how do you go from really loving someone to absolutely hating their guts and shredding them? And not caring about the children in the process. Now, I'm not saying everyone does that, but that really did resonate for me.
Isn't it interesting? Because so with your mum, I'm assuming what she's doing, and I don't know law very well at all, to be honest with you, but she's trying to find, you know, the best case scenario for both sides, perhaps, or the ones where both can win or both can come away and actually reach an agreement. But working with those people after years and years and years of conflict and resentment, and, you know, it's just interesting that you've decided to go, wow, you know, treating the symptom, let's get to the root cause. And certainly one of the things I really took away from your book is that apart from distress tolerance, and I really love the tape measure analogy, I thought that was really, really powerful. But it seems to me like a lot of this sort of stuff, not only from individual childhood trauma and so forth, but a lot of it begins from little things that kind of get bottled up and swept under. And then there's also a lack of awareness as to what our needs are in those moments. And then eventually after years and years and years, it boils and bubbles into these shocking things where, as you said, people are taking each other to the cleaner.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, some people are really great during a separation that they can have sufficient respect for each other to do it well. They don't need the whole legal process to become involved. They just need a lawyer who can sign off their arrangements. And then the other end, and that's actually really hard. Mm-hmm. You have to have a huge amount of psychological maturity to be able to have a good separation. And you have to be able to see your children and your ex as someone, irrespective of the reason for the separation, you have to actually see them as someone with a heartbeat, who continues to have a heartbeat, not one you want to stick a knife in their heart and watch it bleed all over the streets. So it's a huge amount of emotional maturity. And anything that's not in that realm is really hard, because it's actually really hard to separate with maturity. There's a lot of untangling of every single part of life. Nearly everything needs to be turned over and examined. Is this an individual part of my life, or was this part of my couple life that now needs changing? And so anything harder than two people who have that maturity and can do it, it just multiplies and multiplies and multiplies, so that by the time people end up going to court, the children, if they've got them, are absolutely damaged by that point. It is the last option, and it is needed for some people, but it is absolutely the last option. There is an area of called collaborative law, and it's a newer process in the last kind of 20 years. It's been building in popularity, and it's where both sides get a lawyer, but the clients who become parties upon separation, they have to sign a document that says with these particular lawyers they're going to resolve this matter and not take it to court. And so many people who are actually signing up to that, it means we're not going to just get the shits and say, right, I'm done, I'm taking you to court now. It means you have to start your whole legal process again with a whole new lawyer and a whole new firm. So people have already invested. There's a lot. Once you're in that, it's worth your while getting the arrangements over the line. So there's just something very important about the collaborative space, where people have a mindset which is, we are here to resolve it, not to use this as a therapy process or for showing how upset I am with you. And the lawyers actually are not necessarily advocates for their client. They're advocates for the process.
Yeah.
And it's a really different way of resolving matters. So it's a really great model, but you still need people who can think and a willingness to resolve it.
That's super fascinating. You know, similarly, my father is a family lawyer as well. So we both have similar upbringings in that sense, and with that exposure to, you know, what the world looks like in that sense. But what I'd love to ask you, just speaking of the collaborative process versus the adversarial process, have you seen any commonalities in looking back retrospectively in relationships that had led in the way the couples interact with one another that have led to a more adversarial ending versus a more collaborative one?
Totally. I mean, I think there's a direct correlation. We find the type of lawyer who is going to meet our mental state. So if we are angry and embittered, we are not going to want a lawyer who wants to calm everything down and work it out gently. We're going to often want that part expressed in the process. And so what I mean by that is if I'm angry and embittered and furious, I'm going to find a bulldog who's going to allow that expression for me through the legal process. Now, I'm not saying every single person does this, but I see it repeatedly that, and I definitely advise my clients to not go down that route unless they absolutely have to in a legal process, that they're going to be trampled on by what's happening on the other side. And then I actually do recommend some bulldogs. Not that I want to go down that, have people go there. But I see it all the time, actually, Paulie, that if you're wanting to just get things done and look after the kids, then people do want that kind of lawyer who will facilitate that for them.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting area, the law, and it's great that you've experienced that with your dad. I think what's important here is that, we're very fragile as humans. We're very easily wounded, and whatever that is, whether it's in the relationship itself or our ego gets in the way and we can't bear the thought that someone could even leave us. I mean, or that we would need to leave someone, it all gets played out. It's part of the whole kind of psychodrama that we're in at that point. And it can just swallow up a whole system, which is really tragic.
One of the things that I was really trying to pay attention to, so just for context, one of the things I really like about your book was at the very end, you're asking these questions to allow us to start to consider some of these, whether it's childhood trauma, like I said, or just attachment styles, familiarity, and how these things play into our own lives. Then you're asking things like, would this be a threat for you? Do you perceive this? Do you tend to sort of respond to threat in fight or flight? Some people perhaps freeze. And just watching all the ways that I can feel that kind of affect arousal, as even just by reading these case studies, I think one of the things that's so difficult about understanding our egos, you say ego stories, is just how subtle these things can trigger us, and then how that emotion then starts to play into how our behavior changes. So this is a segue from that. When couples are first coming to you, what are some of the typical things that you're seeing? And, whether it's homosexual couples, heterosexual couples, is it one person is kind of dragging the couple to the relationship? Or, what are you typically seeing?
I can see one person dragging the other, and I'll get phone calls where people say, my partner doesn't want to come and I really want them to come. And I'll just say, look, see if they'll come for one session. Because often if people get through the door and they see that I'm not there as a threat and I'm not standing on a podium saying how amazing I am and how crap their lives are, we're all in the human drama together and we're all responding like this, then often they can, they'll sign up to more sessions because they see that it's helpful, not harming them, because I'm non-judgmental. So I don't mind if one person doesn't want to come in. I totally get that. I wouldn't want to go. If I didn't want to go, I wouldn't want to go, and I would protest. So I respect the protesters. And often they're the fortress ones. So if you think about people who've never, ever shared their internal world with anybody, they're not used to people being interested, they have to deal with everything themselves. I talk in the book about the fortress style of attachment. They're not used to people who want to know about how they're doing. They just fix it all up inside and turn bits off and get on with it. So, of course, they're going to be dragged into therapy and their clingy other type of partner is going to say, you've got to come because I want to talk about all of this. And so the protesters are going, no, leave me alone. Let me just do my thing. It works this way. So I really do respect that that's their position. Sometimes people come in and they're just very sad about the state of the relationship. For some people, they come in and they're at ground zero. I really like that. I know it sounds mean, but I really like it because it means they're really going to give it a go. They're not kind of just standing around the edges, thinking that this is just a little fluffy thing. It's like, oh, now I get what's on the line here. I could lose my family. I could lose my in-laws, my house. That's going to be up for grabs because most people have to sell a family home. We might need to change neighbourhoods. So there's everything to lose. And I quite like when people, I don't want people there, but if they're coming in at that point, we can really get down to work.
I'd love to, so we've been shining a light on the conflict side of things, which I think is super important because everyone, you know, in a relationship would have experienced this at some point in their journey. I'd love to kind of reverse engineer this back to before somebody steps into a relationship. I've guided a lot of fathers through the health and well-being process, through exercise, nutrition, mental insights, lifestyle design, all the rest of it. But what I've seen commonly is men experiencing life as a bachelor, independent, being the center of their own universe, and then coupling up, needing to share their universe with a significant other. And then once they, you know, migrate into the family, wider family sphere, then once again, giving of themselves even more. And I feel there's this sense of loss that is experienced during each of these transitional processes. Obviously gain at the same time as loss, but there's a sense of being lost as well, because they can't really navigate the process step by step. So I'd love for you to be able to speak to that and how you've experienced being able to guide people through these processes.
I think you're raising a really critical part about what happens to people in relationships. I see it with men and women about a sense of loss, the loss of the individual self. And I don't think enough attention is placed on that area. So when we do join up with someone, we do go into a place that forms the us and the we. And what happens to that, the individual yearning? What happens to our longings in life just because we've met someone? Where do they all go, our wants and desires? And they can't all be met in a relationship. They absolutely can't. And as all of the processes stack up and life gets more and more serious, there's a lot less space for that. You know, you throw in a kid or two. You tell me a man who's got a lot of free time, or a woman. Everyone's stretched, they're burdened. Many are getting burnt out these days. So I think that that we live with a loss, and that's the loss of the individual self. We don't make room for it, and especially when we have young kids, it's kind of like, how dare you think of going and having that time, you know, when I'm exhausted? How can you even think of going off and doing that, having nights off when I just need to put my head down? And it's very real for both people in the relationship. But I think one of the things I encourage my couples, especially when they've had young kids, is how do you make sure that there's room for you as an individual? Because if you can fill that cup up, you can bring so much more back into your relationship, your own life, your work, whatever, wherever you go. We need to remember that our partner wasn't put on this earth for us. They're separate. We met a completely separate human being who wasn't destined to be our partner. We might have met someone on a holiday, like my couple in the, you know, they met on a holiday in the mountains.
Yes.
We meet someone, and it's not like, oh, goodness, you're the only person in the world I could ever have been with. I mean, really, that's a very limited mindset when people think that. 7.8 billion people, I reckon I could find a few partners in that. So, but they're not here just for us. And if we can remember that every person in a relationship have their own individual self that needs to develop, be nourished in the way they want to do it. And we're not going to always get alignment in that. My partner and I are really, really different people. We're really different. And we're continuously having to navigate the differences between us and how I get my individual self nourished, which I'm very good at, by the way, I've learned after all these years. But it's just, it's a continuous kind of navigation, and we must never take ourselves as an individual off the agenda, ever.
Well, let's stay there. So that is obviously a really important dichotomy, you know, the individual with the weeness, as you say, and making sure that we don't become too out of whack either by being too individualistic and just being self-centered and narcissistic, but also losing our own sense of self in the relationship. What are some tools that people can take away even just right now if they start to feel either that they've lost themselves entirely in the relationship or that due to perhaps having that kind of fortress mentality, they are struggling to open up in the relationship? So I suppose the question is related to how to managing that dichotomy.
Well, there's nearly always going to be someone in a relationship who's going to be the spokesperson. There's usually going to be one person who will describe what they're not that happy with. Listen to them. Mm. You know, unless they're a complete whinger and that's all they like to do, which I doubt, there's often a kernel in there of something that's not quite right, something that's missing, something that just feels off kilter. And I often say to people, take it really seriously, because if we're just dismissing our partner's concerns, that just then steps it into the foundation of the relationship. So if someone's not being nourished enough, as a team, work out, what do you need? How can I help you? Who do we need to call in? You know, for a lot of people, having children adds so much to the plate. That's why a lot of young people aren't having kids anymore. They've seen us do it and they haven't been that impressed with us. I think it's just continuously remembering that this tension between being an individual and a team and being a couple have to both be managed. And then there's a family unit if you have children. But it's have meetings about it, have chats about it. Don't ever let it get off the agenda, because it's a continuous tension that you'll never get the perfect spot. It's going to move weekly, daily, annually. So you just have to keep re-navigating yourself into different places as needed.
Makes complete sense that it's, you know, we're fluid beings, hence our relationships are going to be completely fluid as well. So if you find a point in time where you and your partner and your family even are content or satisfied or thriving even, and then a month from that time something comes up, it's perfectly natural. Everything is going to be continuously evolving and problems are going to arise because we're all individuals and we're all going to be changing, moving and being fluid. And that can be a difficult conversation to have, because one person might be like, hang on, we were just fine a second ago. What's your problem?
Absolutely. And I was actually thinking as you were also saying that, for a lot of people, when they're fine, that's when the space comes up for something else. It's kind of like when you go for a walk, you can get ideas. When things are fine and you're not sort of putting out fires all the time, it opens up the door for, well, is there something else? Do I really want to go hiking in Tasmania and my partner doesn't? What do I want to do about that? Do we want to use these resources for X, not Y? The thoughts come in the peacetime. So I wouldn't be surprised when people do kind of rock the boat a little when it's peaceful.
Yeah, it's and I mean, even just hearing you say that kind of makes sense, because would I also be right in saying that when you are both physiologically relaxed, that's probably a good time to bring up some of these conflicting conversations, because there's not all of that weight in the boat as well, where it's like you can put a little bit on the boat's still gonna manage a little bit of that conflict, but if you're really stressed, it's like a little mouse goes on and everything falls apart.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so sorry, Paul, you go, man.
I just wanted to speak really, really quickly to the next stage in life, and I'm going to be a little bit selfish here in that, you know, the complexity that you've described in children coming into the mix. What commonalities have you found have you seen any amplifications of certain conflicts that may have arisen previously that continue to rise and amplify once kids come into the mix, or brand new kind of conflicts that have arisen as well?
Yeah, I think that is an exceptional question, because we can still have our day-to-day niggles, you know, we can have our day-to-day conflict, but when children come on board, it changes the dynamic because both partners will feel like they're working in the best interest of their children. I'm just going to give you a really simple example, and it will sound a little bit petty, but it really mattered to me. So my husband and I, and he's my ex now, but we had different temperatures. You know, men and women, we can have really different temperatures. So I would then see my children when he would take them out as not being warm enough. And it really distressed me, the thought that my kids who couldn't yet walk or they had tiny little booties on, we were living in London. So I'd be quite freaked out thinking they're not warm enough. They need an extra layer. And he'd be like, no, they're fine, because he was fine. But who's right? We can't actually say. They never turned too blue or needed hospitalization. But it was just something that always stuck with me about me believing that I knew what was best for them, and him believing that he knew what was best. So we're not really talking about right or wrong, but it's the way that we experience the world, and we then impose that filter onto our children, so everything becomes more heightened. Like, did I really want to spend my time talking about another layer of clothing? Probably not. But we can all have lots of those sorts of things, but we can see the world in a particular way, and we're going to then overlay that with our expectations in relationships for our children, how they're going to be raised, how they're going to be educated. And boy, it's a game changer in a relationship, because we don't know what's coming. We think we've had all these conversations before having kids. We have no idea how small these things will be. One person might be really routine, another might be really kind of casual about that. Let them stay up longer. And then one says, no way, they've got to go to bed because I need my tomorrow to be okay. I'm exhausted. So, but I haven't seen them all day. And
sorry to interrupt, Lissy. I wanted to just. I was getting excited as well. But, like, you know, I would imagine that a deeply fluid person and a routine person, for some reason, opposites. And you could probably speak to this as well. Opposites do kind of become drawn together. And let's use like a deeply routined person who has structure in their life and a fluid person who relies a little bit on spontaneity. Have you come up with strategies or ways to hold the space for them to be able to meet in the middle when it comes to guiding their kids or their lives in general?
That question, I'm going to just zoom it right out and take it away from even people having it about kids. If we want to know what is behind every argument, there's fear in some way. Okay. So what is the fear in that moment? For me, it was fear that my kids would be too cold and they couldn't even talk yet and wouldn't know how to ask to get another jumper on. What is the fear about someone who's really routine and someone who's not? Is the fear that the person who's routine is controlling them? Is the fear that the person who's spontaneous is not really caring about the kid's well-being? Then we keep repeating these scenes in different areas of parenting or in life as a couple, and we actually start to think of our partner as someone who's not up to scratch. Someone who's really routine, we might start to think of them as someone who's snuffing out life forces for us. They're just stifling us in a way and controlling us. Whereas someone who say fair and doesn't believe in the kids having to have these strict routines. Now, just look at Asia, by the way. They don't care about that. That's not their thing. Their kids are up till 10, 11, and, you know, a lot of them doing really well. So we do something that puts a rule in here. But that kind of parenting might make someone think they don't care. They don't care about the children if they're cold. They don't care if they're up late. They don't care about their education the next day. But it's not true that they don't care. They just have a very different model. So what happens they could start to lose trust in their partner as somebody who has got this. How do I trust you? How do I go away for a weekend? What are you going to do with the kids? You're not going to care properly. You're not watching their needs. And so it's not just the one argument or the one fight here or there. It's what happens over time where you've gone from someone you've met and trusted and think is pretty fantastic enough. You know, you can see their strengths and weaknesses, but they're pretty fantastic enough. Over time, when we lose trust or we find they're stifling our life force and want to put us in a little routine box, we can build these stories that are quite negative. And then we go from seeing them as someone pretty wonderful who you want to hang out with to someone who's actually not good enough. And that's where the language about them changes, our behavior towards them changes. We might get triggered by them really quickly because we're seeing them and perceiving them as a threat. So it's what happens over and over and over again in all of these different areas.
So how do we break that? Oh, sorry, Tom. I just would be keen. Yeah, you're probably asking the next steps of that. So if we've got this snowball effect that nobody is really probably consciously aware of, developing this within their own minds and almost like developing a completely different person and representation of their partner to what, you know, they had previously in their own mind. And then when they come home from work or their partner, they meet their partner in the evening, they're like, who is this person? and nothing has actually changed from the way the person acts, just the way the perception is. How do we come to not a resolution, but to a meeting of the minds to be able to kind of dissolve this tension, so to speak?
Yeah, we have to. There's several things here, and this is where we're blind to all of this. We really don't know, and that's why I wrote the book. We actually don't know why we're wired in the way we are. So we are all wired up. It's based on all of our experiences we had. We're wired to be in relationships by 12 to 18 months of age. So we think this is just me, but it's not actually me as I chose to be. And that's for anyone in a relationship. It's who I ended up as based on the environment I grew up in, my parents, grandparents, the stories of my family, my siblings, school teachers, school friends, not friends, people who didn't like me. We're just shaped. And then we go, oh, that's me, as if I chose me. I didn't. And so responding in the world without actually knowing how I'm wired up or how anyone's wired up is really dangerous. Because we just keep imposing our usness, our reality on other people and expecting that they will follow suit. But nobody likes to be controlled like that. Nobody wants someone imposing their version on them. And that's what partners in relationships do all the time. We can do it at work to a greater or lesser degree. Friends can do this. But we see it in the most intense form in a couple relationship. So how do we do it? We have to understand what our blind spots are. We need to know how we're wired, because if we don't know how we're wired, we're going to treat our way as a fact, that the way I operate is the way to be because this is how it was always done and my mum was like this, my dad, however it was, we just treat it like this is it. But we've been shaped and we can be unshaped into another version of ourselves, and it's work, but it's worth it. So we need to understand that. We need to understand our triggers. What is that fear behind our difference? What's the fear? Because we keep playing it out, and the more we're going to play out, you're a threat to me, then we are going to be going into fight or flight, and that does so much damage repeatedly in relationships. What do we say in a fight? What do we call our partner? What do we tell them about it then? What tool do we kind of hurl at them and go, or weapon, you know, like spanners or weapons or whatever it is? Do we start blaming them? Do we go global? Do we start telling them how they're, you know, really, you know, have a small penis? Whatever it is, we can be mean. Or we can be frightened and run out of the house and, you know, go and tell all our friends what a creep we're with. But really, is it all that bad, or is it because we've been triggered? But it's not always our partner's fault that we've been triggered. It's ours. Our triggers are our own.
Yeah.
Because they weren't there. They weren't in our lives. They were doing something else, growing up somewhere else when we were forming. My partner's not responsible for my triggers, and nor are yours.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's to me is mine.
One of the things that I really love, and I hope that's not diminishing in value because I've said that a couple of times.
I love it. Keep loving. Spreading love.
Now, honestly, one thing that I probably was probably the thing I enjoyed most about your book was a very, very small sentence. And you said, and this is not verbatim, but paraphrasing, you said, I used to think that in relationships, it was right for each couple to take 50%. And now I don't agree with that. I think it's right that each couple should take 100% responsibility. Could you elaborate on that? Because that was really powerful for me.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard it so many times that people feel like they don't want to be blamed in the relationship or where the relationship is. So they like to kind of shove blame and project it back onto their partner because their ego can't tolerate being imperfect in any way, you know, and that's a survival reason. And I won't go into that in this second. But when this is the point about 100%, we really are, we're not responsible for how we're wired, but we're responsible for all of the actions of our wiring. Yeah. So we're not responsible for how we've been shaped and what happened to us as children. That happened. But we're responsible for what happens that impacts other people. Mm-hmm. And so for me, if I want to really be in the world in my integrity, one of the things is I need to be fully responsible for what I do that impacts other people. So if I've done something that's hurt someone, caused them frustration, I'm going to apologize for that. I'm not waiting to dole out 50% of the blame to them to say, you know, here's an example this morning. I accidentally took my partner's keys. He ran around that house going, "Where are my keys? Where are my keys?" And I'm going, "I don't know," thinking smugly, "You'll have to work this out." And then later I did the text of shame going, "I'm really sorry." Now that's just such a small one, but it's like my pride didn't want to tell him. And it's so small, and I had a laugh at myself, but then I just sent a message saying, "You're going to love this one. You need to sit down." And he said, I said, "I'm sitting." And then so the text went backward and forward, and I told him with like horrified emojis. But we have to own it all, and the little stuff and the big stuff. We just have to own it so that we're not just treating our partner as a punching bag. And if I can 100% own my actions and my apologies and any ruptures that I've caused, then I'm inviting my partner to do the same. I can't expect that they'll do it every time, but I can only be responsible for me. I can't do them and me. I'm not that skilled. So 100% responsible for ourselves, and all our great parts are ours, but so are our other bits that we can keep working on.
And do you see that as well? Do you see, like, say, in a therapeutic session when one partner does take that 100% responsibility, does that evoke a kind of like a de-escalatory situation where the other one can then be invited to do the same?
Absolutely. And now, look, they don't always, because our ego will only let us apologize when we're really able to.
Yep.
And that we can only take responsibility when we've calmed ourselves down. If we're not calm, we're not going to do it, and it'll be inauthentic. So I say never apologize unless you mean it. Like, I will never give a false apology, only when I really mean it. That might take a few weeks sometimes. Seriously, depends how angry I am about something or hurt, whatever that is. I might forget about it and then come back to it later. But, you know, it does, because it's saying to someone, "I respect you enough to put myself aside and say, I can see that I've impacted you." Mm. I'm not waiting for an apology. I'm saying, "I see that I've impacted you. I've hurt you. Mm. That wasn't cool what I said. I stepped over a line. I shouldn't have done that, or I disregarded you in that moment, or I talked over you and didn't give a shit. So I am sorry for that." Mm. So it does something that just says, "I see you." Now, anyone who's been on the planet long enough knows that what we really want from our parents and from our partner is to be seen and accepted for who we are. We don't want to be shaped and molded and pushed and told what to wear, how to be, when to shut our mouths. We want to just be accepted for the being that we are. When we apologize, we're saying, "This is who I am, and I'm sorry for that. I've affected you." But we also want to let them know that we accept them for who they are. So it's important to kind of meet their apology and not say with big egos, "No, I don't accept it. You're not, you know, you're still a wanker and you're small and whatever." You know, we don't want to do that. So there is something that when we are seen and we're validated and we've hurt someone and they go, "Oh, it matters that I hurt you and I'm sorry," we can all just breathe differently. And then that does kind of create that safer environment and trust, actually. It's how we restore trust.
Mm. Yeah.
You speaking about it now makes so much sense, but going through the process, being in the conflict at the time, in the heat of the moment, when all your defense mechanisms are up and you want to protect what is so rightly yours, being your opinion and your upbringing and your truth at the time, it's such a difficult thing to impose this kind of strategy and philosophy that you're talking about. Are there any, speaking of strategies, are there any strategies that you can offer when this defense mechanism is coming up for somebody and they want to be able to defend what is going on inside of them? Is there anything that you can offer that can kind of disarm the situation?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first thing anybody in that state needs to do is calm the hell down. We just can't think. Our thinking capacities have gone offline. We're just reacting. So we're not responding to a situation. We're just reacting. Mm-hmm. And fight or flight, it's really, you know, and there's also faint and fawn and freeze, but we're really just talking about fight or flight with couples mostly. That's just a two-option reaction. I'm either going to fight you or I'm going to run away from you. And sometimes we do both. I can do both. But that doesn't mean we're actually responding or we're being thoughtful or we're using our frontal lobes of our brain. They've actually gone off. They've gone offline so that our limbic system and our fight or flight can just take over. So we really need to just calm down. So that means the break, we have to pause. Nothing will ever be resolved in shouting something out to each other or sulking in another room. It's not going to get resolved like that. So we need to go away and we need to manage ourselves. And what I really say is we really need to go away because that just allows us to breathe. Go and do some breathing in another room. You know, something as simple as 5 seconds in, 5 seconds hold, 5 seconds out, and repeat 5 times. So that's just through your nose, and you can in through your nose and out through your mouth. We need to calm ourselves down, and our vagus nerve will take over and help do that. Then we come back with a spirit of wanting to clean it up together. And if we're not in that place, then just keep separated until you're ready to join up again. Because have you ever been in a fight where you're really upset with your partner and you're saying things to each other and you never do this and you've done this and how about this one? Or, you know, everyone's got their own particular flavour and someone goes, my goodness, you're right.
Right, that's a good point.
Never resolved in that space because the frontal lobes have gone offline. They're wanting to come back online, so they want to come back and help us think. They want to know that it's safe enough to resume thinking. But it's not going to happen if we're still going. So that's where the pause is really important. But we do have to sort of set a time and come back. Because I know when couples leave each other for 3 hours and don't come back, they just feel really awful. And that gets into it that they're not even interested in resolving something. Now, I don't think every fight needs resolution. I think if we can locate it, hey, I just had a think about it and I can see that I got triggered because, you know, when you said this, I felt like it was just really upsetting, reminded me of X, Y, and Z. That's when we've done enough work. Yeah. But we really do need to know our blind spots so we can have those conversations. But behind it all is fear. There's fear.
I love that.
Fear of being disrespected, fear of not being trustworthy, fear of someone being more powerful than us, fear that they're going to spend all our money. Fear. I mean, there's lots of fears. But we just have to understand it's still fear-based. That's why we've gone off or gone away.
Well, Lissy, let's get to some of the questions because, you know, like I said at the beginning of the show, we had to kind of bring this down to the top 10. We had a lot of people that wanted to pick your brain. So hopefully we can do the listeners some good here. But one of the ones that I thought was really interesting was one of our listeners has said, if one partner says they're in trouble with the other, how do we end parent-child language? I thought that was a really interesting one I'd love for you to elaborate on.
So one of the things with that, I do see a lot of couples where one is kind of the one in trouble, and that parent-child relating, it's got a yucky element to it because somewhere in each of their histories, these two individuals know about parent-child relationships and they've had an experience that hasn't gone so well. So what can happen is they're actually two sides of the same coin. So if you can imagine you've got a 5-cent piece, on one side you've got the queen and the other side you've got an echidna, right? One coin though. So if you've got the person who, say, the head coming in as a child, and the other, the echidna, is coming as a parent figure, they're actually playing out a part of the same dynamic. They're connected. Mm. You can only have a parent if you have a child. You can have a child if there's a parent dynamic. So something's being played out where they both need to do some work to understand what is it that's creating this dynamic. Is one of them being a parent because they don't want to feel vulnerable and small? Are they feeling overwhelmed and that the other partner isn't supporting them properly and they're taking up a kind of authoritarian, annoyed, disapproving position? Is the child one, are they always in trouble because that's what they're used to and they're scrambling? I often look at those couples and I do want to just put one thing out that for the person who is the child, who is actually not a child, who's probably doing all sorts of things in real life that are nothing like a child, they might just have some struggles and overwhelmed parts, always just read the criteria for ADHD, because I see that a lot where the child is someone who often feels like they're not quite pulling their weight in a way that one would assume they would. I see that a lot, and it just opens up the question of whether there's ADHD, so attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And that can be definitely, there are ways to help people if that's the case, but it has to be looked at. That dynamic is really tricky because it's very unsexy. Nobody wants to have sex with their parent. And nobody, unless you talk to Freud, nobody wants to have sex with a child a child figure. And so it gets nasty. And for those couples, I would say get into some therapy, read the book, do some work, read up about that dynamic, because there's something that's off kilter, but you need to work it out of your system. It will not go away. It will ruin the relationship over time.
Okay, so individual therapy is as well as the couple therapy?
I would firstly look at ADHD as a possibility, but I think it depends. If the person who's being called a child actually can see some areas that they have some vulnerabilities and aren't as strong, they may do the individual work for that. If they can see that the parent has an parent in inverted commas, has a case to be made. Otherwise, I'd go to couples therapy to understand what is it in both of them? What are they both contributing to this? What's actually happening? So there's definitely work there. This will not go away by itself, I promise you.
Mm. Beautiful. Okay.
Tommy, should we go one for one when it comes to the questions? And should I? What do you think, Tommy?
Questions up on Trello.
Yeah, exactly.
Go for it, my friend.
Yeah. Too easy. I'd love to talk about the insights into the masculine and feminine dynamics and how these also relate to gay couples.
It's a really interesting one. In my work, I don't really focus on the masculine and feminine. And I know that a lot of people talk about it. There's a lot written about it outside online. So it's actually not something that I put onto my radar that often, because quite often I feel like masculine and feminine, this might be outrageous to say, a bit awkward for some people to hear, it can feel like a little bit of a role. It might be a part of a story that we have to be a particular way. So I know at different stages for me that I can move in more masculine, more feminine, more masculine. It just depends on where I am. But I don't actually attach a lot of weight to it in my consulting room, because I really am looking at, I'd be looking at what's the story attached to that. Not to say that I'm not trying to pathologize it at all, but it's just not my focus.
Yeah, I think that's really, really, I would agree with that too. And I think it even more broadly, it probably speaks to just the power of labels. You know, if you have someone who is like, oh, perhaps I need to be a little bit more. I know for me, I have very much feminine psychology. You know, I'm interested in, speaking to what the nature of the feminine is. You know, my mind is very interested in ideas and people and relating and so forth. But if I were to really become attached to that label, I'd be like, oh God, maybe I need to become a little bit more, and it evokes that kind of uncertainty around who I am. So that really makes a lot of sense. I can see how people might, like I said, really become attached to those ideas.
Yeah, and it's a funny one, because sometimes when I hear people talk about it, it makes me even think, because I think, oh, do I need to wear more blouses and things like I understand what you're saying. I go, do I need to wear florally or flouncy outfits? And I don't. I'm not like that. But it is interesting because there's a kind of pull to it, but it isn't on my register.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's do one more here, and I'm apologising to everyone whose questions we didn't get to. And you know, Pauline, I'm probably a bit selfish because hey, it's our podcast, so fuck you all. let's have a look here. So where's one more? Okay, so what about this one? So how to navigate fear of the future in a relationship?
What a great question. I guess the question is, what is the fear? And if you don't have that answer, I imagine there, but is there a fear of the future because there's something in the present that doesn't feel comfortable enough, safe enough? Now, that doesn't mean it's necessarily about your partner. It could be, what is it about me that might not feel secure in this relationship? Because the way I look at relationships, it's that two people are in something and they put up a mirror for each other about ourselves. And so I'm always thinking about, what is it about me that doesn't like this about my partner? Because that's about me. So then I try and work with that part in myself. So I have a partner who works really, really late at night, but that's meant I've had to change my thinking around, what does it mean he's late, he's not home for dinner in this way? Now I actually couldn't care less because I've worked through that fear. And think, because I used to think, oh, we'll grow apart. What will it mean? But now it's like, wow, I get to do all this stuff by myself and I can read and I have a whole life and go out and do what I want. And it's opened up a whole new thing. So for this listener, I'd really be questioning, what is the origin of the fear? Is it a current fear? What is that fear for the future that you've got? Is it that they might cheat on you? If that's the case, what's your history with being cheated on?
Yeah.
There might be a fear of the future because in the present you might not feel like your partner's got you front and centre of mind enough. Now, that doesn't mean they have to be attached to you all the time, but they might not hold you properly in mind in a particular way, and that might make you feel insecure. So the question is, what is the fear? I always think, though, the future's so uncertain, we actually don't know anything about the future. We really don't. We're guessing. We're making it up. We're dreaming. We're playing fantasy. We have no idea what the future looks like, really. We can plan on us that we can do that. But I would just keep looking at, what is that quality now? What's unsettling you about the future now, and try and address that.
Brilliant. Well, Paulie, should we go one more? We've probably got time for one more.
Well, okay, let's do that, because I did want to ask the question that I've asked a lot of guests in the past, but I'll start with one from the audience, which was, have you got, do any like teachers of yours come to mind, and any books or resources that have influenced you and your learning and teachings come to mind that you share with the people listening to the show?
Oh, that's awesome. So I did a psychoanalytic psychotherapy training. Now, I'm not suggesting that everybody needs to do that, but there's a lot of info online as well. But I actually think that if we can understand the ego defense mechanisms, I've got this in my book, but there's lots of info around about this. But it's what do we do when we're scared, when we're wanting to avoid a situation? How do we operate? So anything that's going to open up that question of what do we do inside of our own mind? Do we use denial? Do we justify ourselves? Do we look for external excuses? Do we project stuff onto others? That is really key. There's another book out at the moment which is really fabulous. It's Gabor Mate. He's amazing. And it's The Myth of Normal. And it's a book about trauma. And I think it's an excellent book. I'm enjoying that enormously at the moment. Another book that I highly rate is Eckhart Tolle's book. It's The Power of Now. And also Michael Singer, he's got a book. Oh, what's his book called? The Untethered Soul. Now, the reason I love these books, they're very similar, but they write them differently. It really is about being present. So that might speak to the last listener's question about the future, about understanding how we tell stories in the present. For me, that just absolutely changed my life when I realized that everything that was going on in my head was actually a construction. I felt such freedom. inside of myself to say, that's not true. Ha, that's an interesting one. Have a laugh at myself. The minute we can laugh with ourselves, not judge ourselves, not judge others, that just changes our outlook on life. And then we have a shared humanity. So I think, you know, anything in those kind of areas, fantastic.
Right. Something that I always like to ask is there something that you can think of that individuals and couples alike could implement into their lives like today, something that they could think about, have a conversation about, start to really spark some ideas to go down the path that could start to develop their own selves and relationships?
I think it's everything we're talking about today. It's how do we free ourselves from our own suffering? And we are suffering. We're suffering inside of ourselves. We suffer in our friendships at times, a lot of pressure on relationships in general. We suffer at work. We suffer with our children because they're not doing what we want them to do and they're not, you know, going to bed as we want them to be, or they said, you're a poo-poo head, I hate you. We suffer because we're taking these parts of ourselves so seriously. And when we stop looking at ourselves as the center of the universe and taking ourselves that seriously, we can actually free ourselves up and give everyone else the space to be themselves. Mm-hmm. And so if there's one thing, it's that everyone just do the work. Free yourself from the suffering that is your own mind. You know, there's a lot of people who create a lot of drama inside their own mind. We all can do that, but it's a fabulous story. It may have no fact. And I once heard someone say, whatever doesn't get taken, when we die and we're in the grave, whatever disappears with us is a story.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever's left is a fact. So if we think about how much of our day-to-day lives will die with us because it's a story and it's not actually a thing, we might really start thinking about what we're creating in our minds.
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. That's very liberating.
So I want everyone to liberate. That's why I do this work. And I want everyone to see what they're doing, to become less judgmental. It's the most liberating thing to just see we're all in it together, that we're all actually the same. We're all little egos, balls of energy saying, I'm hurt. And this is how I do it. Here's my particular flavor. So if we learn that, then we go, oh, there you are again. Interesting. I don't have to attach to that. I don't have to suffer. And so that would be my one thing for everybody, is to do the work. Get interested in how you operate.
I love that.
Totally.
So where can we find you online, Lissy?
So I have a website, which is lissyabrahams.com, and I've got some podcasts and some TV interviews there and some blogs. I've got a newsletter, come join the community. I look forward to seeing you both in there. People can feel free to email me at lissyabrahams.com. So, yeah, keep in touch, everyone.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, it's such a pleasure to have you on, Lissy. Like I said, you know, when came across the book, Paulie and I will often tell each other the guests that we really, this is one of the reasons why we both love doing the show together, aside from being great mates outside of it, is we come from two different perspectives. And he's like, Paulie's like, oh, you're going to try this one. Oh, we're going to speak to this one. So it's really fantastic. And thank you so much for saying yes. The book was really, really great. It's definitely something that I'll jump back into as well, because there was a lot of information that I feel like when you read a book, you know, you're getting 10 to 15% of it. I'm like, oh, I've got all these bloody dog ears in this thing now. So I'm going to have to go back and hit it. But thank you once again for the show.
You're so welcome. It's been an absolute delight spending this time with you. Really great.
Thanks heaps, Lissy. You've been a wonderful guest.
Thanks, Paulie. Lovely to meet you and hang with you both.